This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Dr. Michael Blavis, Chief Medical Officer at Anavasi Diagnostics, joining us once again on the phone from Atlanta. Doctor, thanks for sticking around with us as we heard from the president. Your immediate reaction to what we heard from the president, it wasn't necessarily a different message than we've been hearing from him for months.
No, it's a consistent message. The theme is everybody has to pitch in to try to control the pandemic spread, and now more of a focus on the fact that booster shots, immunization will protect you from getting very sick, going to the ICU, possibly dying. But infection probably has to occur still. And the only way we can control it is isolating ourselves when we're positive. So the theme of testing.
Right, right. And this is something you are developing your own at-home test. And I know that is still working its way through in terms of toward an Emergency Use Act and stuff. How do you see kind of the testing situation as we speak? And I'm guessing these kinds of tests will be with us for a long time.
Yes, the tests will keep evolving. Others will put the high accuracy tests on the market in miniature form like we're doing. But it's interesting. A lot of tests are out of stock when you go to your grocery store or pharmacy. The home kits are out of stock.
Tim and I are nodding big time for those on radio.
Preaching to the choir, my friend.
Absolutely. And then also at the same time, the FDA has started to make a list of tests that may not be so accurate for Omicron. And we're likely to see that in the future even more with additional mutations because tests main target the wrong area in Omicron now, an area that is mutated from Delta. So more and more concern about that.
Wait, what?
Yeah. Can those tests, so let's say, some tests that are common, a Binax now, for example, from Abbott Labs, could a test like that be altered? Could a test like that be altered by Abbott to pick up different variants in a better way?
And how quickly?
Absolutely. Someone like Abbott could work that out very quickly, but then they'll have to go through the emergency use authorization procedure again. So realistically, you're talking about several months in most cases, which is light speed compared to years ago. But absolutely, Abbott could make that adjustment, and so could others, and others probably will have to do that in the future.
It's an interesting world. Tim and I were also talking about the cost of tests. I mean, they're not inexpensive, certainly, the at-home tests.
Let's just be honest. Carol texted me last night, at 9:36 p.m.
When I bought mine.
And she said, I found some tests at this drugstore near the office. I went this morning and I picked up four.
We have and thank you, Creedy, because she's the one who's like, hey, you got to check out this pharmacy. So it's been like a little network inside of our offices. So we do find them. But I do worry about people who need to work, can't afford these tests, maybe are vaccinated, fingers crossed they are. I mean, we need to just get tests out. I think over in the UK, one of our colleagues said the National Health Services, just supplies them.
Yeah, and the same thing was done in Switzerland, where every family was given five tests per family member for each month. They could test regularly. And as a physician, one of the greatest challenges we had in the emergency department are low-income folks that are working. They can't afford the tests, and they also can't afford to stop working when they're sick or feeling sick. That means they infect others. It's a really difficult position to deal with.
So how does this pandemic end? We're entering year three of it, doctor, and I'm just, this is a pretty exasperating time, I think, for a lot of people, especially those with young kids who are not in school as a result of this and are concerned because those kids can't be vaccinated yet. I'm speaking about myself. How does this end?
Sure. I think probably we learn to live with the virus and its different mutations. Hopefully we get more mutations like Omicron that don't make people quite as sick. Overall, the immunization or immunity in the air in the community and the society goes up, and we have more very highly effective medications so that one day in the future, Omicron is a little bit more like the flu, there are susceptible people. They get extra immunizations. If you get the flu, we actually may have more effective medications against Omicron than the flu, and I think that'll absolutely be the case in the near future.
Dr. Blavis, just got about a minute or under a minute left here. What's the outlook in terms of, I know you guys are working on submitting your COVID test for FDA authorization under the Emergency Use Act. Any update on that?
Yes, we just started enrolling patients. We're hoping to be done enrolling patients by the middle of this month, maybe the third week. And then if all goes as planned, we'll get the emergency use authorization by the FDA to start selling on approximately March 1st.
All right. Well, good to know. And we wish you good luck with it. Certainly, it seems like the world is just appreciative of the more tools that we have to deal with this. Dr. Michael Blavis, he's Chief Medical Officer at Anavasi Diagnostics, joining us once again on the phone from Atlanta.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Carol, you had a BlackBerry.
I did. I loved it.
How many years do you think you had it?
My CrackBerry?
Yeah.
A few years.
Remember that.
I do remember it. And I didn't quite get it until I got one, and then I was like addicted.
And then as soon as the iPhone came along, what happened?
First, I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And then
you wanted that old keyboard back, right? You wanted that physical keyboard.
Did you have one?
I did have a BlackBerry.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, but I went to iPhone pretty quickly.
And you can do so much more with a smartphone.
Yeah, you really can. It's a lot different. But it's certainly fair to say that it ushered in a new era when it came to smartphones and personal technology. Well, it's the end of the road for BlackBerry.
Rest in peace.
At least the BlackBerry operating system. We should know.
Good point.
We should note that you can still get BlackBerries that are powered by Android. Joining us now to talk all about it is John Butler, Senior Telecom Services and Equipment Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us on the phone from New Jersey. John, how many people is this going to affect? BlackBerries are like, they're like unicorns, right? You see them in the wild and you're like, wow, there's a BlackBerry.
I was listening to you guys talk. I had a BlackBerry as well. I don't see a lot out in the wild anymore. I'm not sure it's really going to affect many people. And BlackBerry years ago.
My name is Carol and I have a BlackBerry. It's like, you know what I mean? You wonder if people hide it, right, John?
There's a few of us out there, but I switched to the iPhone pretty quickly, too. But, you know, it was one of those corporate liable phones, like companies paid for your cell phone and gave you, in my case, I had a RIM pager, if you remember the old name, Research in Motion.
Yeah.
And, you know, you eventually moved to two phones, and people loved BlackBerry so much that they ended up hanging on to the BlackBerries for a long time. And honestly, 3 or 4 years ago, I used to see a lot of BlackBerries out in the wild, so to speak, and I'm just not seeing them anymore. So, Carol, to answer your question, I don't think there's a lot of users at this point that are still hanging on. But, you know, from a corporate standpoint, it's something that BlackBerry needed to move on from that. They really are a software maker right now. They've moved into mobile software and security software, and they sold off that handset business years ago.
Now,
so
it's a good point, right? They've been going through changes, John. So how do you see the outlook or the future of BlackBerry?
So they are still a company in transition. And I think a lot of people would have thought at this point they would be out of the transition and growing better. And they still have to make some moves. So speaking of handsets, they had this huge portfolio of intellectual property for wireless. And they're trying to sell that right now to fund R&D to get a bunch of new products over the finish line. And we're almost there. You know, it's one of those stories you can see it beginning to come together, but they need more funding and they need a little bit more focus. And, you know, my sense with them is I think they'll get there. It's hardly a given, but I think they're on their way. I think it was high time that they finally kind of let go of that wireless business. Even a couple of quarters ago, they were still reporting what they called service access fees. So people who had a BlackBerry would pay a fee to get access to their proprietary network for email and file transfer and that kind of stuff.
Hey, John.
And so that'll go and it'll free up some cost.
Hey, John, I wonder if there's any sort of lesson in here about business cycles and companies and companies staying on top of things that we can learn from the rise and fall of BlackBerry, especially the day that after Apple hits $3 trillion in market cap. Because if we think back to 2007 when Steve Jobs stood on that stage and introduced the iPhone, there were a lot of people out there who said, there is no future for this thing. BlackBerry dominates when it comes to smartphones.
You know, I think the lesson learned is, particularly in the tech industry, some of these gigantic companies can literally disappear. Mm-hmm. And or they can disappear from a given business, as was the case with BlackBerry, but they really are a shadow of their former self, if you will. But LG just left the smartphone business, and they were a pretty big player for many years. And so, to me, I always use BlackBerry as an example of how these tech behemoths can really fall from grace and ultimately disappear over time. And I think the other lesson, and I've learned this over the years as an analyst, is that it's important to have the right CEO in place at the right time in a company's life cycle. And I think Apple is a great example of that. I think Tim Cook came in right at a time when Apple had reinvented, their product line was set, but they needed a logistics guy to really grow it to where it is today.
Yeah, exactly.
And Tim Cook, I think, was the right guy to do that.
All right, John, hey, we got to run. Thank you so much. Always appreciate your insight. John Butler, Senior Telecom Service and Equipment Analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Obesity is a disease, and there are ways to fight it, including prescription drugs that work. The problem is most doctors are not prescribing them, and insurers won't cover them. Let's get to the reasons why.
Well, Emma Cord is healthcare reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from New York City. Her story is going to be featured in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can read it now, though, on the Bloomberg Terminal and also online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us now on the Access line from Brooklyn. Joel, Carol mentioned this group of drugs. This group is known as GLP-1 receptor agonists, or GLP-1s. What do they do?
It's very catchy, right?
Yeah, it is. For the pharmaceutical industry,
rolls
really has
tongue.
A way with naming things, right?
Yeah, exactly. But you know, regardless of name, the science behind these shows promise. And as Emma goes into in the story, the drugs and this class of drugs is really geared, maybe not at just, you know, those stubborn 5 pounds that we'd all like to get off, but at a whole category of people who really haven't had that many drugs for them before, which is obese people. And obesity being such an epidemic in the country, numbers that are stubborn and really don't go down. And yet, you know, doctors have this stigma around it. It's like, it still in their mind can be a behavioral problem that science can't necessarily solve. Insurance on top of that looks at this new class of drug and they're not necessarily throwing money at it. All of which, you know, kind of leaves this solution to a big problem somewhat on the shelf. But now I'm talking out of turn and I want to hear more from Emma. So Emma, how did this story come into being, and what kind of potential does this class of drugs really, really have?
Hi. Well, thanks so much for having me on, and I hope everyone who's listening has a chance to check out the story. The piece started, there were a couple of early threads, but I started hearing about some startups that were trying to treat obesity and help people with weight loss using medication and telemedicine. So these like virtual doctor's visits. And I thought it was sort of an interesting approach. And at the same time was hearing about pharmaceutical companies trying to develop better obesity drugs. And, you know, as I learned more about the space, I just kept coming back to this point of like, you know, even previous to these GLP-1 drugs that are starting to be developed for weight loss and obesity specifically, they were previously been used in diabetes. You know, there have been prescription drugs that can help people lose weight that are rarely used. You know, and this is going back several years, and there's a lot of different complicated reasons for that. But I kept kind of just being struck by this discrepancy between the fact that, you know, many people are obese or overweight in the U.S., you know, hundreds of millions of people. And yet people are consistently being told to diet, to exercise, and they're not being told about this other option that's available for them.
All right, Emma, the thing I find like crazy, like blows my mind a little bit is, and you write this, the biggest constraint on weight loss drugs remains buy-in from the broader medical industry. How can doctors who potentially see this as something that could really, like prescribing one of these drugs, help one of their obese patients, how are they allowed, you know, as a doctor, not to prescribe it?
That's a really good question, Carol. And I think, you know, I quote a doctor, an obesity doctor in the story who says sort of, you know, if you treated diabetes or hypertension in this way, like, you know, a doctor would lose their medical license. I mean, it's kind of remarkable that, you know, we're very comfortable prescribing, and by the way, I mean doctors prescribing medications for so many different kinds of medical conditions. And I think a lot of this has to do with the way obesity has previously been seen, right? People think of obesity or being overweight as really being a something that you kind of did to yourself, right? And we kind of get into this more in the piece, but you didn't work hard enough to lose weight, right? This is your fault. As a result, this is treated as a lifestyle condition. It's you're eating too much, you're not active enough. There's some more complicated science that's come out in the last several decades that shows that our bodies really do have a big influence over how we, you know, when we stop eating, you know, when we're hungry, when we feel satisfied after we eat, and that there's more biologically going on than merely sort of, you know, refraining from getting on the treadmill every day, which is what I think a lot of people unfortunately still think, and even doctors and certainly people who struggle with their weight themselves.
Well, I'm just going to make one comment because I know Tim has a question, but I wrote a note, being obese is big business and it supports a lot that's out there. Anyway, that's my opinion piece there.
It does, and it's a good thing for us to be thinking about in the new year when a lot of people have different fitness goals and weight loss goals that are associated with the new year. I want to talk a little bit more about that, Emma, and obesity, because I'm always shocked to see these statistics about, you know, how many Americans are obese or overweight. 3 in 4, an estimated 245 million people. Can you talk a little bit though about comorbidities here and the dangers of being overweight? They've come to the surface a lot when in discussions of COVID, but beyond that.
Yeah. So the big kind of concern about having excess weight is obviously that's defined by the body mass index standard, right? So people who are obese are at higher risk of developing various medical conditions, including diabetes. Another risk that's tied to obesity is actually all-cause mortality, so literally death by any cause. So we know from some of these statistical analyses that, you know, when you are you carry around extra weight, you are more likely to develop some of these other medical problems, and you know, it does raise a lot of concerns for doctors and medical providers about your health, right? Are you as healthy as you could be? And as a result, it's led to a lot of interest in finding ways to keep pounds off, obviously not just for, you know, reasons of appearance, but also really health reasons.
So to wrap here, Emma, let's talk briefly about the science. How does this class of drugs that we're talking about here, the GLP-1s, how do they work?
And Emma just got about 30 seconds.
So they do a couple of different things, especially when you're talking about diabetes. They actually help the pancreas, get the pancreas to produce insulin to bring your blood sugar levels down. But when you're talking about weight loss specifically, what's really interesting about these drugs is they mimic a hormone called GLP-1, right? These drugs are named after the hormone. And it actually kind of helps tell your brain, like, you're satisfied, you don't have to eat anymore. And that's kind of the key to it. It's funny, people might think of the, you know, their gut hormones, but they actually work most potently, it seems, in the brain, which is kind of a fascinating thing to think about, this being really neuroscience at the end of the day.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Listen, guys, thank you so much. It's a really wonderful story. I mean, troubling story, but you should definitely check it out with all its details. You can find it at Bloomberg.com. Emma Court there and Jill Weber.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Later this month, we're going to get an update on Netflix when it reports its latest quarterly results. This is the company's edging closer to investment grade status. It's what you call a rising star, at least according to our Bloomberg intelligence team. That is about the upgrade to their investment grade status.
Let's get into it with Olivia Raymond-Day, credit markets and high yield bond reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from here in New York City. Olivia, great to have you with us. Can you help us make the connection here between what exactly is going on with Netflix right now on the credit side, and what we've seen with Netflix's stock in recent years as it's continued to just fly higher.
Yeah, so thank you so much for having me on. So Netflix is poised to become a so-called rising star at some point this year. And what that means for listeners who aren't aware of that phrase, that just simply means that a junk-rated company is moved into investment-grade status and all of its debt gets moved into investment-grade indices. So Netflix already has one high-grade rating from S&P. They upgraded Netflix last October. So all it needs is a second high-grade rating from one of the major rating agencies for it to bump up to that rising star status.
So tell us about what that means, because that means basically what? Servicing your debt costs less.
Yes, exactly. So when companies leave junk status and become investment grade, they can get financed from a deeper pool of borrowers at lower rates.
So what are the changes that the company's made in order to boost its credit rating? How has this happened?
Yeah, so their credit metrics have performed and have been improving. They have raised an ample amount of liquidity, and they've also signaled that they are not going to need to take out much more debt in the future due to the recent successes that they've had, especially over the pandemic when everyone was stuck at home watching movies and shows on the streaming service, and boost its viewers. So that's helped it shore up some money and need to tap the bond market less frequently.
Well, okay, so just help me out here, because I don't cover the credit market closely at all. So, I really focus, I look to a lot of the equity performance, and here so far, in 2021, Netflix was underperformed the NASDAQ, but finished higher by 11%. It was higher by 67% in 2020. It was higher by 20% in 2019, 40% in 2018, 55% in 2017.
You're talking to the credit market person about the equity?
Yeah, because what I'm saying is the rating for the credit rating hasn't really dissuaded equity investors here.
So have they been stupid?
No. Thank you, Carol.
No. What we're seeing
or smart? Did they have foresight?
Yeah. What we're seeing is investor foresight here. They're anticipating that Netflix fundamentals will continue to improve. And that's reflected in the credit rating analysis that the major graders send out as well.
It's like fair to say it's like a lagging indicator.
Yeah, right. Which one? The equity market?
The credit market.
Or the credit market.
Yeah.
But isn't the credit market often... Well, so tell us about... Right, we spend so much time, as you know, Olivia, talking about the equity side of things. But the credit markets, can often tell you very quickly if a company's in trouble. So I'm just thinking about for our audience who watch both things. But again, we talk so much about the equity side of things. What does this potential upgrade also mean in terms of how investors overall look at this company, or maybe should look at this company, especially when you dig deeper into that balance sheet?
Yeah, for sure. The important thing there is that what happens often is when a company is upgraded to investment grade, they issue bonds very shortly after because they can get them at a lower yield. And so therefore, they tend to trade better than the broader market. So according to Bank of America strategists, and this is a quote, rising stars should be bought as soon as possible. And that's not just for Netflix, but for the potential $169 billion wave of rising stars that we could see this year after we had a very large credit rating downgrade during 2020 amid the worst of the pandemic.
Hey, just quickly, and if I think about on the equity side thing, we talk so much about indexing, right? Or people who are invested in index funds. Same thing, though, if you're, the credit is upgraded, right? You're more likely to be in a lot more corporate indexing funds or index funds.
So that's exactly what happens.
Yeah.
Once your company is moved to investment grade status, your debt leaves all high yield indices and it's moved into investment grade indices.
All right. Makes sense. Good reason to keep an eye on Netflix, and always important to look at the credit side of things. Olivia, thank you so much. Olivia Raymonde, she's credit markets and high yield bond reporter on the phone in New York City. You can't say you're not a credit person.
I'll admit
it.
You
look at all this stuff.
We do, but I, you know, rising star, that works pretty well for Netflix.
It's a better trend than maybe.
It does. It works so well for Netflix. It's a show that it's a company that is focused on stars, whether, you know, that's Squid Game or was that movie? Power of the Dog, Carol, that you liked?
Yeah. Tim recommended it. I'm sorry.
I liked it.
I lost. It was lost on me.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive, so you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so just got about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We are driving to the close. Let's bring in our guest, Lori Heinle. She's Global Chief Investment Global Chief Investment Officer over at State Street Global Advisors. They've got $3.86 trillion in assets under management, managing a lot. And she joins us on the phone from Boston. Lori, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Doing great. Seeing a little bit of sun finally.
Oh my gosh, right? It feels good. It's, I don't know. It's a little gray here, but interesting first couple of days of trading. 2 days does not make a trend, and yet we're bouncing off our lows here today. What's on the mind of investors right now as they try to make investment bets and maybe kind of set up their portfolio for the new year?
Well, lots of things are on investors' minds right now, but two of them are things that have been on our minds for quite a while now, COVID and the Fed. Mm-hmm. And those two things are moving in a little bit opposite directions right now, because obviously we have concerns about COVID, particularly Omicron, but we're also starting to see that perhaps this version of COVID takes us to more of an endemic situation where it's less about the pandemic and more about learning to live with the virus. On the other hand, we've got a Fed that seems to have moved quite hawkish quite quickly. So those two things are likely to be what will battle it out in the first half of 2022.
Okay, so give us an idea of asset allocation, because we spent a lot of last week talking about fixed income and whether or not there actually is a role for fixed income in portfolios right now with the direction of interest rates and where they are now. Do you think there's still a role for fixed income?
Well, certainly asset allocation has not gotten any easier, and there are a couple of dynamics at play. First of all, we've had pretty lofty valuations in lots of parts of the equity markets. But as you note, given that fixed income interest rates are just so very low, even with a little bit of a backup here, fixed income's just not that attractive. So we've been trying to do a couple of things. First of all, look for other opportunities within equities where relative valuations are more attractive. Mm. So we've recently been repositioning out of U.S. more into Europe, where we think they benefit from the cyclical trade and we can get more attractive pricing. But we've also looked at fixed income places where there's a little bit better yield. So looking at credit, looking at emerging markets debt, for example, and perhaps putting a few other diversifiers in there, including commodities.
Interesting. U.S., though, versus the rest of the world, how do you see it?
Yeah, well, so for many, many years, the U.S. has been our core equity position, and we've been overweight at times pretty significantly mm-hmm. versus the rest of the world. But we actually think 2022 is going to be a time when you want to pivot and focus a little bit more on non-U.S. assets. If you look at the rotation from kind of growth stocks into more cyclical sectors, European indices are just much more represented in those cyclical sectors, which should benefit as this recovery takes hold. So our trade is really more out of U.S., although not terribly underweight, but more into European for more high growth opportunities for investors.
So are you betting that in 2022, Europe will outperform the U.S.?
Well, at the moment, that's the way we're positioned. And again, we think there are a couple of things that put a little bit of wind in the sails of Europe. As I mentioned, a bit more cyclical representation. So those are stocks that should outperform as we continue into the growth sector or growth engine, if you will, as the economic growth recovers. We also think that the central bank there will be a bit more dovish, which should provide a bit more opportunity for valuation expansion. And we also think that Europe has a lot of other dimensions, notably being willing to have a bit more fiscal stimulus, which is something that has not happened in Europe really for the last decade.
How is, Lori, kind of the great decoupling that we might see among global central banks? In other words, you know, will we see spheres of monetary influence? Not my words, but our Tom Orlick, chief economist at Bloomberg, and he's looking at this great decoupling of global central banks where we will see some raising rates, some not, or some even cutting rates. And, you know, certainly when you look at something like China versus the U.S., you could see two giants in the global economy pursuing very different monetary strategies. What are the implications of that?
Well, first of all, I think that's spot on. Again, keep in mind that the backdrop for literally the last decade has been to try to stimulate growth. There wasn't any inflation that was any of any concern to any central bankers. And so they could be much more dovish in their posture in support of markets and in support of economies. But now we're in a different place where we are starting to see inflation in some parts of the world, notably here in the U.S., where, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed's suddenly gotten a lot more concerned about that. We also have different growth factors here. So China, for example, has seen their growth rate slow pretty dramatically over the last couple of years. So it's a combination of inflationary pressures, growth trajectory, and also just, you know, how there are other dynamics like the fiscal policy that are going to come into play here.
Hey, Lori, you know, we talk a lot about inflation and that certainly being a concern for many strategists going into 2022. When do you think inflation peaks?
Well, we actually think that we may have seen the worst of it.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean that we're going to go back to the 2% rates that we had enjoyed, you know, pre-COVID. But what's likely to happen in our view is that the beginning of 2022 will still have, you know, higher than normal inflation, but the inflation drivers will start to rotate a bit. So, for example, energy prices were a big driver of inflation in 2021 and likely will continue a little bit into 2022. But suddenly the comps on a year-over-year basis will become a lot different. On the other hand, we think that things like real estate and owner's equivalent rents are likely to tick up in the second half of 2022 as we start to see some of those rental prices continue to grind higher. So we think we may have hit the peak or very near the peak, but that doesn't mean we're going back to that sub 2% level.
Jobs and the labor market, do you think it continues to provide some optimism going forward? Just got about 20 seconds here.
Yeah, we do. We actually think that there could be a bit of an upside surprise to the consensus number of just over 400,000 and maybe more in the form of revisions versus the actual print for last month. But we do think that manufacturing will hold up well here and the service sector, while being a little bit challenged right at the moment, is likely to be pretty resilient.
Right. And we did get some optimism from the ISM manufacturing. We did see delivery times and prices improving, coming down in terms of prices and delivery times reducing, which maybe that supply chain constraints getting better. All right, Lori, we got to run. Happy New Year. Lori Heinel, she's Global Chief Investment Officer at State Street Global Advisors. Tons of money, almost $4 trillion in assets under management. On the phone from Boston.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.